Professor Stein, for the second interview, I've grouped the topics under three main headings. One, overseas visits as a scholar to Italy, the United States and South Africa. Secondly, your time at Cambridge as Regius Professor. And thirdly, your various extramural activities, like memberships of committees. If we could begin with your overseas studies as a visiting scholar or professor, covering the period 1951 to 1998, although they took place over a long period of time, it might be more systematic to bring visits to a particular country under one heading, starting with Italy, which you visited several times.
Well, I was a student in Italy, in a college, Collegio Borromeo at Pavia, the only college founded by the only millionaire saint in the Catholic calendar, St. Charles Borromeo, in the 16th century. And I lived there for an academic year and learned to be familiar with Italian, and that meant that I could go to conferences where the language of the participants was Italian, and also could converse with Italian professors without too much difficulty. And it was while I was there that I knew I had to get a job when I'd finished in Italy, and before I got the scholarship to go to Italy, I'd been for an interview at Nottingham, and I got a letter from Nottingham inviting me to have an assistant lectureship in law. It was, I think, to be £500 a year, they said, but you must only come if you stay a year. And just a little later, I got another letter from my supervisor in Cambridge, who was David Dauber, and he was in some ways the biggest influence on my life, because he was a Roman lawyer, and he excited my interest in Roman law. I didn't have any particular inclination that way when I came up. I had rather assumed that I would become a solicitor and practice in the family firm. But Dauber was very keen to get me to specialise in Roman law. But I said, well, I'm committed to Nottingham. I remember I wrote and said I thought I should get paid a little more since I was a qualified solicitor. And the London County Council at that time had a permanent advertisement for as many solicitors as they could possibly get without qualified experience something like 600 a year. Anyway, they said, no, that was the scale. So I said, oh, now I wanted to be an academic. So I said, all right. And then I got a letter from the administration saying, we have just noticed your age and that you are 26, and therefore we have to pay you £550, I think it was, by virtue of your age. So I wasn't terribly enthused by that letter, because I thought, I'm probably too old, I've missed the boat. But I spent a year just in Nottingham. But Dauber had persuaded Aberdeen to offer me a full lectureship, which they did, And so I said, well, I've got to finish my year at Nottingham, which I did.
And just before you went to Nottingham in 1951 to 52, this was the time when you were the Italian government scholar.
Yes.
I wondered about that. I wasn't sure.
Technically an Italian government scholar, but I went for the interview at the same time as them, because the Pavia College sort of studentships were filled at the same time, and we were treated as equal to Italian government scholars. But the one I had was a scholarship offered by the college in Pavia. And I thought the experience of college life would be very valuable.
And was it?
Yes, well, particularly with the language.
It was another 40 years before your second visit to Italy.
I'd been several times, just, you know, for a week or two, and to give the odd lecture. But what you've got here are the times when I went formally as visiting professor by invitation. And whenever I got leave to go abroad, I usually went to America or to South Africa.
Do you have any recollections of your time at Padua in 1991?
That was somebody who'd been an Italian who had been here, said, would I come and lecture in Italian at Padua? And that was the spur for the invitation. Mm. And the same with Palermo. I went to Palermo in the winter time when it was quite cold. I thought that it would be warm.
You also went to Salerno in 1994.
And that was the same. I'd met someone at a conference and he said, oh, you speak Italian, come and lecture in Italian at Salerno. Which was a new university so far as law was concerned. It had been founded long, long ago, but there was no continuation. But he put me up in a hotel by the sea and fetched me every day. That was very pleasant.
It sounds very, very nice.
It was very nice, but in some ways the visits I made just for a week or so at a time in the vacation, our vacation, were more influential because I meet interesting people.
Do you recall any of these people, Professor Stein?
Well, yes, I suppose I became friends with some, particularly there was Giovanni Pugliese. He influenced me to some extent. And among the German speakers, Kaiser, who was probably, and Wiacker. And Kaiser and Wiacker were together the two most influential Germans among the Roman lawyers, because Roman law is a fairly close-knit community. And thus say, the most influential man on me was Dauber, who was the professor in Aberdeen when I went there. He'd supervised me in Keyes. And it was he who insisted that I specialise in Roman law and so on. And of course, the fact that I'd been a cadet during the war, a naval cadet, when you were allowed to do some academic work, and I was a classic then. I hadn't turned over to law, so I had a bit of a grounding in Latin, having studied classics in 1944, and in a way Dauber exploited that, and he in some ways was the most interesting teacher, well, in every way, the most inspiring teacher I had, because he was a very charismatic figure. And in so far as English law is concerned, the most interesting supervisor I had was Geoffrey Lane, who was a weekender. And I think any account of law studies at that time, just after the war, should emphasize the influence of weekenders, people who are practitioners, but who came up sometimes on Friday evening or Saturday morning and did a series of hours of supervising. And my common law supervisor for 2 years was Geoffrey Lane, who later became Lord Chief Justice, Lord Chief Justice Lane. And I kept in touch with him after, in later years. And I suppose he influenced me to some extent.
Interesting, Professor Stein. And you visited Rome in 97.
That was the Lateran University, which is a Catholic university. I'm not a Catholic, actually, but they didn't mind that. But there are several sort of private universities in Rome which are affiliated to the church. And this was bang next door to the Lateran Basilica, and I gave a course there in Italian.
Was that on Roman law?
Well, it was on it was the sort of topic of this book. It took Roman law and then went on.
We come then to your visits to the United States, and apart from the obvious pleasure of visiting the United States, was there any particular reason for so many visits to America?
Well, money. Virginia I liked because it was a lovely place, lovely setting, and nice colleagues. Very good law school.
Are they particularly active in research on Roman law, the Americans?
Well, they had a wonderful library, and would get any books I wanted, but I mainly worked there on the influence of Roman law later on. I have an article in the Virginia Law Review for about 66 the influence of Roman law in early post-revolutionary America, which I wrote while I was there.
I must dig that out. Do you recount, is there any particular circumstances or related to this visit or any people that you met?
Well, everybody was very kind. I remember there's a very, very nice atmosphere in Virginia.
I know that you produced a thick teaching manual for Virginia in 1979.
Did I? Oh,
It's the history of the European Civil Law, selected materials, spring semester.
Yes.
And it's 256 pages.
Yes, it's photostats, which they very kindly produced for this course, because I said there wasn't, I didn't have any materials, but I could make some, and they said, do that in the first semester, and then it'll be ready for the teaching in the second semester.
So you went back there again in 1978?
Yes.
You also went to Colorado?
Well, that was the Dean of Virginia very kindly arranged. He knew that I had a whole year's leave of absence from Aberdeen, and I said I'd like to go to the West, see a bit what it was like, and he arranged for me to teach at the University of Colorado for a summer school after I'd done two semesters at Virginia, and some of them would drove across in an old Volkswagen minibus, because I had three children, three daughters with me, and they had went to school there. I remember I went to see the school where the elder two were going, and the principal said, "Oh, I ought to warn you, I can't guarantee their safety." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, this is the first year of full integration, and there'll be black children at the school." So I said, "Well, I'm prepared to take that risk." And the first day, car was parked outside, and I took the two girls, one in each hand, to walk them across the street. And a photographer came along and photographed me looking the wrong way, because, of course, I just arrived from, you know, looking when people were driving on the left here, and they caught me sort of looking that way for the oncoming traffic. But no, it went quite well, but of course they were children very young, and the result was that I was mostly concerned with domestic matters that year. That was in the 60s.
1966.
65, 66 it was, yeah.
It
was the only time I got any leave from Aberdeen.
You had about four visits to Louisiana State University from 74 to 1985, Baton Rouge.
That's because I met, I have a friend, George Pugh, who's a very cultivated Louisiana scholar, and he got me interested. And of course, teaching in Scotland, I was interested in the mixed system, Louisiana and Roman Dutch law in South Africa.
I wondered about that.
Yeah.
Five visits to Chicago from 1985.
Yes, well, the Chicago are unique in having a quarter system instead of a semester system, so that the quarters are more or less like our terms, and they can offer many more courses overall than the ordinary average American university, in that you can have a course just for a quarter, which is about 8 weeks, and I could do a shortish Roman law course at that time. And they liked that, and so, because they liked to be able to offer something unusual, and very few American universities offer Roman law. So I used to go and teach Roman law at an elementary level for a quarter, and that's, and then they'd say, well, come back next year. And that's how it was for. But I couldn't every year.
85.
Because of committed. So I used to go more or less every other year.
And you went to Tulane in 1992,
yes. 96
and
98. Yes, well, I retired from here in 93. So, but Tulane, because it was in New Orleans, was a more exciting place than LSU at Baton Rouge. But also they had a wee bit more money and could afford to pay me. Baton Rouge, being a state university, was always rather hard up.
So while you were in New Orleans, you lived in downtown?
Yes.
And then travelled on the tram?
Yes.
To the law school?
The streetcar went up the avenue, that's St. Charles Avenue, which was the St. Charles of my college in Italy, St. Charles Borromeo. At least I think he was, and I once asked a nun that I met at a bus stop, I said, you know, this is St. Charles Avenue, is this St. Charles Borromeo? And she said, well, I believe it is, and she wasn't quite sure. However,
you also visited South Africa in 1970.
Yeah, that was an invitation I got from the WITS Student Visiting Lecturers Trust, and I asked Ken Polak, Bursar of Kings, who's a South African, I said, do you think it's okay to accept this? And he said, well, who's given the invitation? And when I told him, and he said, well, as long as it's not the South African government, you're all right. He advised against accepting any official invitation. But I went under the auspices of this student's trust to WITS, when a man called Scholtens was professor of Roman law. And he was from Amsterdam, he was a Dutchman. And I enjoyed that experience very much because of the survival of Roman law.
Sort of a hangover from pre-Dutch
code. Yes, yes.
But I know what you mean about consulting beforehand, because politics and law have always been so closely intertwined in South Africa. And the 70s were perhaps the height of the political isolation.
Well, yes, I mean, at WITS and Cape Town, which were both English-speaking universities, they didn't... I wasn't so aware of the political side of it. The dean at WITS, whose name I can't remember for the moment, you probably know it.
I was never at WITS.
He edited the, I think, the South African Law
Journal. It couldn't have been Boberg or...
No, Boberg was around. I knew him. But it was...
Cowan.
No,
Van Warmelen, no.
Van Warmelen.
He was probably at Pretoria.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Yes, I knew him. Alison Kahn. And he was a very nice man.
Very prolific.
Yes.
Did you, when you were in South Africa, did you see Professor Beinhardt?
Yes, I went down to Cape Town on the train.
Oh, lovely.
And he looked after me there, and I gave a couple of lectures. I'd visited him, and he'd visited me here before, he'd come round, I think, in Aberdeen. But I remember he lived in a nice house called Tusculum, which was Cicero's house and in Rome. And he was extremely helpful.
He was from Malmesbury, a South African, small South African town called Malmesbury.
Yes. Didn't Smuts, wasn't he born in Malmesbury?
That's interesting. I must find out.
I think so. because Smuts was the Chancellor of Cambridge when I was there, and I received all the degrees that I could in person, and I remember kneeling before him because he spoke Latin but with a very strong Dutch accent.
That's very interesting.
And he had a fabulous record because he'd been, he got nothing but firsts when he was doing law in Cambridge. And
I think he was at Trinity.
No, he was at Christ's.
At Christ's, right. I remember reading that he was terribly homesick.
Quite
during that time, and rather pressed financially.
Yes. Yes, he was a very interesting man, because of course people like Churchill were fascinated by him.
Really?
And and he was a prominent figure in both world wars, as well as the Boer War.
When you say Churchill was fascinated by him, can you elaborate?
Well, he often quoted him, and he was a member of the War Cabinet, the Imperial Cabinet came over in order to attend meetings. That, and Churchill took his advice a lot on strategy and that sort of thing.
That brings us to the second part of our talk today, which is your time as a Regius Professor at Cambridge from 1968 to
93.
When you returned...
68, it must be.
68.
Yeah.
When you returned, Professor Stein, in 1968, the faculty had greatly expanded its staff from the time you were here at Conwell and Keyes. And I have a list of professors who were in place during your tenure. Can you remember any of them?
Well, I remember all of them, but I don't have any particular anecdotes about them. Of course, Tony Jolovich was a contemporary of mine as a student. And his father was a famous Roman lawyer.
Did you know his father?
Yes, he was very kind to me. And when I got back from Italy, his father was professor at Oxford, and I wrote to him and invited me to lunch. And then he said, you better come back home and see if Tony is there. So I went back and he said, there he is. Like, the only thing I could see, just a pair of feet sticking out from under a car. And he emerged, and it was Tony. He was fascinating. He knows all about how the internal combustion engine works. And
someone was telling me.
Because you see, as I say, Roman lawyers are very thin on the ground, and we all stick together. And he was the professor in Oxford, so. Naturally, I had to pay my respects to him. And he knew I was going to Aberdeen then.
Did you keep in touch with him?
Yes, of course, he died. He moved to Oxford. Well, no, he was already at Oxford then, wasn't he? And he had succeeded to Zuloeta. And he died of a heart attack in, it must have been, when he was still in post in his early 60s. And that's when Dauber was appointed from Aberdeen to succeed him in Oxford. And that caused a bit of an upheaval in Aberdeen. And they looked around for a professor for a year, and I gave the lectures. And in the end, they appointed me.
When you were just 30 years old?
Yes, I was only 29, I think, when they... So it was quite an upheaval.
Gosh.
And I had to... Of course, up till then, I've been doing almost exclusively Roman law, but the chair was the chair of jurisprudence, and I had to teach both Roman law and legal theory, and so I spent a lot of time then learning about Scots legal theory,
which must have extended your horizons greatly.
Yes, because I am half a Scot. My mother was a complete Scot. She had been a student at Girton, but she'd been at school in Scotland, and I think that was the first time she left Scotland, when she came as a student here to Cambridge.
Do you have any recollections of Glanville Williams, Professor Glanville Williams?
Yes, I'd always admired him. And so I suppose Hampson was the most dominating of these people, so far as running the faculty and that sort of thing.
Started these English Legal Methods Summer School.
Yes.
Which, as I discovered last week, was as a result of his experience in the war when he was a prisoner, and they were lecturing to each other during that time.
Yes.
And it gave him this idea.
But the most influential, from the point of view of giving lectures, was a professor that I don't think you've got here, called Bailey.
Ah.
I think his initials were S.J. Bailey.
I have a photograph of him, actually.
Have you?
Yes, I'd like to show you after
I'd
you've
like
spoken.
I'd like to see it.
Thank you. Yes, that's very interesting.
I thought his lectures, he lectured on real property, and I thought they were the most sort of interesting that I'd ever heard. I was fascinated. Of the lecturers, the man who attracted a lot of attention was Barnes, who lectured on criminal law. But people, he had certain sort of set lectures. There was a famous lecture on this English criminal case of whether you could commit buggery with a duck.
That was one of his...
And people used to flock into the lecture room for that one lecture. And then when he talked with a put-on Irish accent, it was conviction, quiet, he said, and used to turn over the page. And then people used to leave. But I always thought Bailey was very underestimated as a teacher. Now, he wasn't called by his real name. I think he was known as Dennis Bailey, but I'm not quite sure. But his initials, I think, were S.J.
Well, thank you so much for telling me this, because I have asked about Professor Bailey from other interviews, and nothing has been forthcoming, and this is perhaps why I left him off this list.
Yeah.
I'm extremely interested to know this. Thank you. Perhaps Professor D.G. Williams?
Well, No, I mean, I've known him personally for a long time, but I don't suppose I...
Professor Jones? Professor Gareth Jones?
Yes. Well, and... again, I mean, both Jones and Williams were slightly younger contemporaries of mine, because they're both a year or two younger.
Professor Baker would have been in place.
Oh, yeah, yes.
And to some extent his interest must have coincided.
Well.
Or not.
Yes. I've always sort of admired him.
And then the Yule Professor Crawford.
No, he came.
After.
Or almost when I was.
About to.
About to retire, because.
He's.
Didn't he succeed Jennings?
Bowett.
Oh, no, Bowett, that's right. Of course, Bowett I saw quite a lot of, because we were both at Queen's.
Yes.
But, and I was his vice president. He was president of Queen's, and he made me vice president. So I deputized with him, so, which was quite nice.
Yes. Any recollections, Professor Stein, of some of the Goodhart professors? These would have been some of the names.
Yes.
This is just a...
Yes, well, Trainer was an interesting man. He'd been Chief Justice of California, and... unfortunately, he was Goodhart Professor in the same year that Archibald Cox was the Pitt Professor, I think, of American institutions. And at that time, the law school had a claim every 5 years or something on what the Pitt Professor. And this was just after... some scandal, was it Nixon or something?
That would have been, that was around the time of, yes.
Yes, and everybody wanted, and they both gave lectures in the law school, visiting lectures, and I remember I said, I was dean then, or chairman, and I said to, Cox, what are you going to lecture on? And he said, Watergate. And I said, well, we can't call it that. And he said, well, you call it what you like, but I'll lecture on Watergate. So I called it, I advertised it as Select Problems in American Constitutional Law. And he said, all right. But all the students called it the Watergate course. But then people used to ring me up as chairman and said, can we invite Cox to come and lecture? And I remember saying to the chairman at Oxford, who I think was Morris, who's on this list somewhere, you can only have Cox if you also have Trainer, because I didn't want Trainer to be overshadowed. And he was a very quiet, modest man. And so Morris said, okay, we'll do that. And so they were both invited, not, I think, at the same time.
That's very interesting. There we are, Morris, 1979 to 80.
Yes.
He was...
He's the conflicts lawyer.
Van Meeren was here in 1983 to 84.
Yeah. Raoul, I know quite well. He gave in effect my LLB lectures. Oh, you mentioned somewhere in these papers Ullmann.
Yes.
Now, he wasn't a member of the law faculty, but he was all this time. In fact, he was there before I came back in the history faculty, and he was a professor of medieval history
here at Cambridge.
Here in Cambridge, yes. First of all, I think medieval ecclesiastical history, and then medieval history, perhaps something like that. And he influenced me quite a lot. Because, and I remember I said, I would like to lecture for the LLB on the later history of the civil law, because I've always felt that was neglected. And he said, well, it didn't have any later history. He was a very dogmatic person. And I said, well, I think I can find some. Do you mind? And he offered a course for the LLB students, as they then were LLM now. He said, no, you can. So he we did some sort of deal, and it was I got on quite well with him, and he influenced me. In fact, one or two things I wrote because he had suggested. Because when I was at Aberdeen, I went to two conferences in Italy where he was also present. One was marking the centenary of Gratian's Decretum.
Oh.
And the other was oh dear, I can't remember now. Both of Bologna. Oh, the other I think was the centenary of the founding of the University of Bologna, which they'd had to fudge because no one can remember exactly when it was founded. But he was at both, and we saw quite a lot of each other there during that both weeks. So was a man who can't. I mean, he always taught medieval Roman law for the LLM, and we saw quite a bit of him. David Ibbotson wrote him up in that Juris Uprooted very fluently.
I must have a look at that article. Professor Reinhard Zimmermann, this is a bit later, here. He's no doubt somebody whom you have had quite a bit to do with. He was at Cape Town at the time.
Yes, I'd corresponded with him while he was at Cape Town, and I've seen quite a bit of him since he had left there. He's very good at getting money from foundations for conferences and visits and things.
Well, he had a room just down the passage with Mr. Goodhart, Professor. Professor Stein, there were a further 58 or so non-professorial colleagues during your tenure at Cambridge, and I have a little list of some of them here, not all. I wonder if you have any recollections of Mr. Pritchard, Mr. Michael Pritchard.
Well, again, he was more as a contemporary, as a student, and so was Elie Lauterbach, but I didn't have a great deal of intellectual
Mr. Ellett, someone else who was in place?
No. Well,
Dr. Forsyth, perhaps?
No. Well, I think he was a student, but he went. But I don't think I ever taught him.
All of your time was spent in the old schools, but it must have become very crowded. 2 years after you retired, the faculty and the library decamped to this site. But there must have been several years of planning and building before you retired. Did you play any part in this?
Well, I was on one or two committees, I think, that I remember going on a visit to the Oxford Law School to see what facilities were available.
The old building also housed the Squire Law Library. Do you have any memories of any of the library staff, for example, Mr. McVeigh?
Well, I remember we already in the old schools, we'd all become very, very reliant on Peter Zavada to find us things. So I knew them all.
You were a member of many committees and bodies. This brings us to the third part of this talk. Can we run through some of these, starting with your academic committees? You were a council member of the Max Planck Institute for European Legal History.
Yeah, well, that was a man, a continental, who influenced me a lot, Professor Koing from Frankfurt. And he had founded the Max Planck Institute for European Legal History, and I was one of the people that he brought on to the Scientific Council, Wissenschaftlicher Beirat, and I stayed on until it was disbanded. He was a very dynamic man. They're a French Huguenot family. Coing is really Coin, the French for corner, because he said that this evangelical congregation had services in French once a month, even in Frankfurt, until the war came and they had to stop. But it was he, I think, who really showed me that there was an awful lot that could be done if you didn't stop studying Roman law at Justinian, but went on into the Middle Ages and then into the Renaissance period. And I was able to see early Scots law in that light, and I was able to get them a lot of historical works on Scots law for the library in Frankfurt, which is an excellent law library from the historical point of view.
You were also a council member of the International Association of Legal History.
Yes, that's
of less importance. I couldn't actually find them on the website.
No, I don't.
Perhaps of more significance, your membership of the International Academy of Comparative Law.
Don't I've never been to any meetings with them.
I noticed they had meetings every 4 years.
Yes.
But the British Academy, you've been a member of since 1988 to
1990. No, since I became a member of the British Academy in 1974.
Let's rectify that.
And, but I suppose on the University of Grants Committee, I was 5 years on that because they were whole years, you know, from January 71 till December 75. And you don't represent any interest or any institution there, but they usually have one or two from Oxford and Cambridge because they're special types of university. And but I was the only academic lawyer, and so that this was the period when there was a report, I can't remember now, on the future of legal education. It was the Ormerod.
That's right.
Yes. And the UGC had to implement the recommendations of the Ormerod Committee. And that was where my experience in America told, because I was convinced at Virginia and Colorado that our law schools at that time were far too small, and that the only way you could generate the income to pay the number of teachers in the various legal subjects was by growing, having more students, because ultimately, however way, the law schools were financed, that the amount they got depended on the number of law students they generated. And I had a bit of influence in growing.
Moving this forward.
Yeah, growing the law schools, the size.
When you consider the numbers from the 70s, that's when I was, you know, first started as a student, to today, it's quite...
Yes.
You were also on the UK-US Educational Fulbright Commission.
Yeah, that was
several years.
Long after I retired. Well, no, I suppose not.
85?
No, I was still not retired.
Not quite.
It was when I... I think if I haven't been on the UGC, I got on some list in the DES and they invited me to join the Fulbright Commission. Yes, it was technically the US-UK Educational Commission. And but it was quite interesting. It was mainly choosing people for scholarships. A bit of interviewing.
Professor Stein, one thing that impressed me when gathering information about you is that given your very heavy academic duties and scholastic output, you have had membership of so many other bodies, which, if you don't mind my saying, seems to me to point to your being very public-spirited.
Well, I've always felt I ought to do a little bit in the community, as well as my academic work. But I don't think my academic work was all that onerous, in that, unlike some branches of law, Roman law doesn't change all that rapidly, and therefore my lectures didn't change an awful lot and didn't require continuous preparation and reinvention. But
you coming to your non-academic membership of these bodies?
When I was in Aberdeen, one of my university colleagues got me onto that board for mental hospitals, and that was, I've always felt the mental hospitals were rather the Cinderella, the hospital service. Especially at that time, they were often full up with very old people who'd been dumped there because there was nowhere else to put them.
You were sick.
But that working party on hospital endowments, I got put on that because I was chairman of the mental hospitals, but that they needed someone to represent the interests of mental hospitals. And
you're also the chair of the Ely Diocesan Trust.
Yeah.
And president of the Public Teachers of Law Society.
Yes.
And your time as the vice president of the Selden Society.
No, that time I never had anything with that. But
they published one of your books.
Oh yes.
Teaching of Roman Law in England around 1200.
Yeah, well, that was a manuscript that was discovered in the British Museum, and well, if you, the preface to that book explains the history of it. It took a long time to identify it, really.
I hope we can come back to that when we speak about your work. You were a Justice of the Peace in Cambridge.
Yes.
What did that entail?
Your magistrate, and we sat in the guild hall, and it was about one half day a week regularly, and I succeeded Arthur Armitage, who'd been the president of Queen's. There'd always been a tradition that the university, particularly the law faculty, supplied one or two magistrates to the local bench, and Armitage was one, and Trevor Thomas, who was a lecturer in the law faculty, became vice chancellor of Liverpool University, and he was the other, and somehow I succeeded Armitage, and John Hall, who was a good friend of mine, succeeded Thomas, and
so people would come before you and you would give sentence or...
Oh yes, well, magistrates always sit as three and decide by majority, but I suppose sentencing was the most problematic aspect of the work.
In what sense, Chris?
Well, I mean, the most scope for disagreement.
Presumably not fairly, obviously not terribly serious.
Oh, well, no, I suppose. But you see that you have to take them in stealing a book from heifers can be quite a serious matter.
Yes.
But on the whole, didn't have much problem with guilt or innocence. It was usually clear enough. But as I say, I had problems deciding what the appropriate sentence was. I'm on the whole rather on the lenient side. Some of my colleagues on the bench wanted to be more severe. But no, it was just, as I say, one way of keeping in touch with the life of the community, because I didn't do any more hospital work after I left Aberdeen, and the magistrates' work that sort of took its place.